In today's society, it feels like it's a crime to be authentic. And it's almost as though you get punished for being who you are. I think there's a good story by Jordan Peterson. He was talking about this study where they're analyzing zebras. They couldn't work out what zebra was which, so they put this red dot to differentiate. But every time they would come back, the zebra was dead. They couldn't work out why. And it was because the predators could unify their efforts to attack the single zebra. When you put yourself above the pulpit and you're authentic, you own who you are, you magnetize certain people to the point they love you, they trust you, they care about you. And then you also get people to hate you. It was Mike Tyson that said, a man that's friends to everybody is an enemy to himself. So in this podcast, we talk about authenticity, meaningful connection, and also how to grow your business. So if that's of interest, have a listen. I've been thinking a little bit about leads lately. I just, every morning I've been doing like a 15-minute keynote because I spoke at Financial Advice NZ and it was crap in my opinion. So I've like, because I didn't prepare and I want to be good at like just winging a whole speech. So today I talked about leads and I'm wondering what your perception is on what you do. Like you've got a new, someone's given you a lead, either it's a referral or for someone else. Do you have a process? Do you psych yourself up? Do you call immediately? Do you text? What's your
It's a mixed lead bag. Strategy? It depends. Most of my leads are from past clients, and so over the weekend I got 3 introductions, and there's one that's an anonymous on Facebook saying, does anyone know a good mortgage advisor, and the others are, look, this is my friend, please look after her, here's her email, here's all information. So in those instances, I feel that I've already, I mean, those introductions are perfect, so you know you're already in a position of trust, so I basically reach out, say, hey, look, I'll have a look through the information that's been fired through, then touch base, let's catch up either on the phone or a Zoom or ideally in person, and take it. Just let me get your big picture, fill in the gaps, et cetera, et cetera. People leave out the bits that they don't think reflect well on them, and they're the bits kind of, you know, that are going to be, that's been the fly in the ointment before, so let's find what they are and let's get rid of the fly. If I get a lead, we've recently started doing Mortgage Magnet, I think it's called. Not my normal space at all, totally outside my comfort zone. So, I probably had 6 or 7, through that service. Am I wrapped? No,
mortgage
not really.
Magnet.
I think that's what they're called. So yes, you basically get sent, some fundamental, you know, people have clicked on something on social media, and you get sent the base details. And been a very interesting, because it's very, very different to how I normally work. So in those instances, oh, sorry, it's a phone call trying to come through. In those instances, I will try and get a little bit of, you know, background information and call them up and say, hey, and most people are really surprised that you're a real live, genuine person. And that is not a bot or some marketing company or something. And it's, there is a process. Sometimes I do research. I research into the properties they're looking at, the properties they've got, how many other properties they've got, who their lenders are, what's on the title. You can overthink it. If it's an investor, I'll try and get some sort of gauge on what their portfolio and appetite is, how their spread is. And so that when I'm talking to them, if I can see that they're very much into new builds or very much into existing dwellings or into cash flow with apartments and that, it's, you're not going in. Quite often by the time people speak to us, they've been thinking about this huge scenario for so long. By the time they come to us, they just go, bleh, and give you the tail end and expect you. It's like, no, back up the bus, back up the bus. So mixed bag. Sorry, I can't give you a straight answer on that. Everyone's an individual.
They are. I mean, you talked about something as important as authenticity. Like, I think it blows my mind how important authenticity is and how well it does in business and life and relationships and how rare it is.
It's horribly, you know, rare. It's horribly rare. I think that's why I paddled my own waka for so long doing this, because I just thought trying to find a tribe that had the same, it sounds so corny. It sounds wanky. There's no getting around it. It sounds so corny, but somebody had those same ethics and actually genuinely gave a shit. I wasn't finding it prevalent in my industry, and that was the bottom line. I mean, it was a real issue. But you know, now I found the right tribe, and they've handpicked people that are in the same space. That helps. I think a lot of people, here we go, deeper meaningful. I think a lot of people don't want that relationship. I think there's a, I get the occasional call through things like that mortgage magnet where in actual fact, it's an arm's length. I don't want you to know too much about me. Here's the information. I want you to just process it. And it's almost like a prostitution. It's a case of, I don't want the relationship, just do it, just make it happen. But, you know, it's just like prostitution. You know, you're not going to get the same kicks out of it. But actually, if I know what you want, I can actually make this happen so much better. And it's going to be big picture, long-term gain for everybody. You know, no, I don't want to be your best friend. But you've actually got to trust. And yeah, so I must say I've had two or three, deals, and they have just been deals. They've not been ongoing clients. They're people that want to jump from bank to bank to bank. And I'm not a churner. I'm actually, let's build your empire or your financial security brick by brick. You know, it's a long-term game to me. Whereas those people, because they don't want to actually disclose a full picture, they don't trust. They haven't found that the right person yet. They hop from advisor to advisor, and you can tell they have because they send you a totally pre-packed file with all the base documentation, and it's don't ask for anything more. It's like, actually.
That's interesting.
It is bizarre.
There was, I think there's a YouTube guy, he's like the most hated sales trainer in the UK because he helped people with cold calling and stuff. And he believes you don't need to tell them what company you're from, your name, or even be their friend. Which is, it's interesting. I'm the opposite. Like, I will just talk shit with someone on the phone and try and befriend them and be authentic and leverage on relationship. But sometimes you do. You come across, you know, the CEO of a 100-person company that's limited time and doesn't want to build relationships and wants to know why and wants clear boundaries. And how do you navigate that? Do you give them what they want or do you look for your kind of people?
I think that there's... it's really important to establish what their knowledge is. I mean, if they're an absolute guru, then I'm not going to tell them how to suck eggs. But you need to establish that there's an awful lot of people, and dare I say, it's not, you can't generalize it into age category, but they've watched lots of podcasts and they know lots about this and their mate got this. And they think, and you realize actually it's a veneer of knowledge and it's been all from one source. They haven't actually, and not necessarily the source of truth or reality or present even. It may have been really applicable 18 months ago, but it's not like that anymore. So, yeah, finding out, actually getting a good handle on where the people are and what their knowledge are and how. Another big thing is, especially if you're dealing with a couple, to me it's really important that both members of that couple know what they're going into. If both names are on it or they're both directors of the company, etc. And that's another one. I've had some people actually say they don't want to take things further because it requires, I require to actually meet the other party, their partner in it, and make sure they're actually all over it and up with the play and they understand it. And it's, this is my game toting. It's like, well, actually, she's bouncing along in the back of the trailer. Just make sure she's comfy, eh? It's very tricky. So yeah, finding out. I mean, that is part of that introduction thing. Just getting some, and other people come in and they're totally, unabashedly green. And I'm absolutely cool with it. I've got no problem. It's for me. And now I'm not going to try and vomit gallons of information. You moderate your language, accordingly. When English is their second language, it's a really big deal. You need to make sure, this is no disrespect at all to Pacific Islanders, but they have a really big habit of sitting there saying yes. And you actually have to throw in the reverse weirdo question. When they say yes, you think, yeah, okay, I could scrub all the previous yeses. Let's start again. And I say to them, we need to make sure we're all good with this. And so I'll rephrase things and ask them to explain back to me because it's important. It's an important decision.
It's a huge decision. Yeah. I think it's an art. Like, some salespeople say if they think someone has more knowledge and they probably don't, but you don't want to go against their self image. So you say, as you know this, how do you navigate people's fragile egos when they're actually not using the source of truth? How do you break it down gently?
I think pragmatic's probably the nicest word that's been used for me in that department. Blunt, honest, but it's always with love. And it's like, mate, you know, you seem to have this all together. So let me run through a few checkpoints. Have you covered this off with your lawyer? Have you covered this with your accountant? Let's tick a few boxes and make sure we are totally in the same space, because I don't want to make assumptions. Assumptions are just really, really backfire.
Makes an ass out of you and me. Never assume anything.
That's a good old cliche, but yeah. To be honest, some of the biggest egos I have come across have actually, once you've got through that bravado, they have had vulnerabilities. I had an instance quite recently where it was an external family member for the people who are looking at the lending that was very interested, and it came from the right place, but the big character, quite foreboding. And I said, look, bring them in. We need to make sure everybody's good with this. If they've obviously have impact and bearing on the couple involved, let's talk. And it was a generational difference. And I sat there and I took the rap for everything every bank has ever done wrong for the first 5 minutes. And I steered the conversation around to the current scenario that we were looking at. And I said, you've obviously got a lot of reservations about what these people are looking to do. Let's drill down on that. A lot of people of that era made a lot of wealth out of property. They just happened to have it. They didn't really do it. They rode a good wave. And so the ego's up there as in, I've achieved an awful lot by doing this. But actually, once you say, I'm trying to help the people you love, just like you are, let's use both of our skills. Let's get rid of, leave the ego at the door. Let's sit down. What are you strong at? What am I strong at? Because there's no point me telling them one thing and you saying, that's dosh, the bank's a rip-off bastards. And I said, because you're undermining what I'm saying. I've gone out there and looked for the best deal in the market and you're saying it, it's bollocks. And it's like, it's not. It's sharper than a spiky thing. So if you want to sit down, I'll show you what I'm looking at. And so I give trust. I show my cards. And the irony is that then you've got this phenomenal ally in that situation. I felt absolutely the trust that was given. I suppose once I'd shown that where my interests lied, and that is actually getting the right deal for the, the valued client. We got there. And yeah, I think I probably got a champion out there now. Hopefully, he's saying, "Bank's a bastard, but Nicola Shirley's great."
Yeah, we used to do a lot of financial planning. Am I still here? It's locally recorded, so like, if there's a lag or if it's awkward, it doesn't matter. It'll still come out.
Oh, I see.
So don't stress. But in financial planning, it's a lot of advisors would make the mistake of taking credit for the returns. And then that's when the pitchforks come out, when the markets go down. Whereas the guy I worked with, he'd done it for a few decades, Greg Moore, he would always put the ownership on the fund provider. So there's a degree of separation. It's like, hey, I'm actually helping you.
Mm.
As long as I'm providing good service, it's appropriate for you and consoling you through the ups and downs. I can't control the returns. I'm not responsible for those returns, but I am responsible for how I service you. So creating that degree of separation, is that something you consciously did and being like, okay, the banks are the banks, but I'm just here to make sure that I do the right thing for you? And then also, how do you balance not having leverage? Your income comes from a separate entity that at any moment could be like, oh, we're going to pay you something different. How do you sleep at night? How do you balance the...
The reason I'm probably not a very wealthy person is I don't actually think about the financial side of it at all. If somebody actually asked me what the trail of was a certain bank, and it's I should know, but I don't. It's not part of the equation. It is a separate entity. I think actually building the reputation with the bank and is just as important. Once you've had as many years under your belt, and as I have, I don't submit something I wouldn't approve myself. I set a really high bar on what I will go through it. If I just think it's not got a shit show, I'll say, guys, this is where I see the weaknesses. If there's something we can do about it, which might mean short-term, long-term, easy fix, not whatever. we address it. So I think the banks and the assessors, you know, which is a panel, no matter how you look at it, they get used to seeing the material from people who have been around the sun like me a few times, and they know what they're going to get is straight up. It will have everything that they need. There's no bullshit. There's no fudging. There's a situation where there's, we had one the other day, what was the other day, it settled just before Christmas, that there were so many reasons why you wouldn't put this deal in. It was tighter than a fish's bum. But I'd done that much research and spent that much time with the client that I actually thought, I'm going to champion this. It's got unseen, non-apparent merits. And I was stoked because we went through a whole lot of trials and tribulations with going through a certain hangar, your partnership deal that got pulled at the last minute on them. And it was, we finally got the lend through one of the banks that partner with them, purely because that assessor gave me the airspace to explain why I actually felt, it's like, look here, look there, see this, see that, as I documented it. And I said, it's got legs. And in the end, they actually invested the time. I sent them a photo of the solo mum and her two kids outside the house when they settled, because it was actually, it's making a difference. It's hard for those assessors that are further back, you know, to lose sight of the end result. It was a worthy lend. It's a solid, safe lend. Obviously, it meant the absolute world to the client. And under 98% of circumstances, there's no way on earth it would have happened unless that assessor trusted me. The client trusted me. The assessor trusted me. And we were able to present it in its true light rather than it just being tick box assessing. And the assessor got a kick. She actually got to see the happy ever after, whereas they don't really. They just move on to the next file.
Mm. It's a tricky place. Like, I'm really grateful that banks exist to, you know, have access to capital you wouldn't normally have, that you have a relatively safe place to put money. It hasn't, no banks failed. One bank got close. I can't remember what it was called.
They do have their moments, but.
Yeah, what is your thoughts on the whole, you know, the money system and, you know, the way that they're lending out money and then printing money on demand? What would you say to people that, like, you can't trust banks, the world's going to implode? What's your take on the money system?
It's the Western world. It's the same no matter where you look. I remember when I was doing some finance papers way back, I had to do an assignment on the 1989 Reserve Bank Act. And the digger deep, the uglier it got in the reality. But it gives me more understanding as to why Adrian Orr is doing what he's doing now. And that is that our international reputation and rating is important. Whereas the man in the street, they really couldn't give, you know, which is tit about it.
You can swear, by the way.
I'm trying really hard not to.
You're done well. I mean, you brought up prostitutes, so you should be able to swear at least.
it's a case of, yeah, we don't want to look like a banana republic, but anyone actually that read cover to cover any mortgage document wouldn't go near it. But all you can say to them is, look, yes, all of the cards are on the table, are on their side. They can do absolutely anything they want. They can call it in at any point. They can up it, they can down it, they can do whatever. But it is the mechanism by which they lend you money and enable you to move forward. So as long as we have a relatively stable economy, and we do have those checks and balances and a supposed independence between the Reserve Bank and the political side of things, hopefully our economy won't actually implode. For investors, I'm not an investment advisor, but through the banking years, you know, and somebody comes in just to, you know, saying, I know, money guaranteed to get this back. But it's shocking because they put money everywhere and they can't remember where they put it. It's like, no, you moved that away from us. I think you went down the road. It's a tough one, but it's capital. You know, the changes that have happened over the last 10 years, the capital adequacy, the tightening of lending criteria, painful as it is at some stage, I think it, it is for the better. I think there's been more good done than harm. And I think the continuous refining that we see to get the triple CFA and so on working balanced correctly is all for the better. Taking a lot of cowboys out of the game, eh? It's so nice. I'm not actually the lone stuck up goody two shoes anymore.
Yeah, the standards increase. Well, for listeners, like, it was pretty once upon a time. So a good story was that I applied to be an insurance person selling funeral insurance, and all I needed to do to become an advisor back then, I don't know how long ago, maybe 7 years ago, was pay for something like $500, do like a minute of compliance, and now I'm qualified. And I can call people up and say, hey, I'm a financial advisor. Whereas nowadays, you know, you have to go through the right competencies, the right trainings, and you have to be part of a certain group. And then you also have to have a certain level of continued professional development, and you have to follow a strict process. So a lot of people that think financial advisors are this way or insurance brokers are this way won't actually realize that there's been a shift. I'm calling
shift.
A lot of the old blokes. They're like, oh, God, I'm just over it. It used to be fun.
I think they're the ones that struggle most, to be honest. And as we enter into the transition and the changeover, and as the audits start, I kind of worry for some of those, because there's no doubt they're exceptionally experienced advisors, but one can only suspect that they don't jump quite through the hoops that the FMA would like to be jumped through. I mean, that's why I moved under a FAP, somebody else's FAP. I know that I have total confidence I do the right thing by the client. My record keeping and that is tight. My justification and communication is logged, But I still felt vulnerable, and I thought, actually, I need friendly fire. I need someone to actually make sure I'm meeting each and every one of those things. So I don't want to lose my license due to a technicality. But I don't know that how deep that runs in the older advisor network. A lot of them just hung up their black calculators and sod it off. I mean, I've had people come to me in that same time frame, and they've literally said, oh, and I've got an offer from another advisor, but I want to get a second opinion. And I say, oh, let's have a look. Let's see what we can do. And it's literally all but on the back of a napkin. It's like, wow, do you know what this means? There's lots of arrows and pieces of paper on this piece of paper, and numbers and X's and underlines. And they're like, no, not really. It's like, okay. The concept isn't a bad one, but let's tidy it up and make sure there's that understanding, and that, you know, those days have gone. And it's a good thing. You know, the documents we send out now, I say to people, print them off, keep them. If you've ever got a concern or a wonder, or why the hell did we do this, it's a snapshot of that, where you were at the time that we did that lending, and the why. You know, it's... We don't want people saying, no, surely we were earning this sort of money then. It's like, no, you weren't earning that then, actually. No, you still had a student loan, a car loan, and 15 gym cards. You know, it was a different scenario then. But then you review it, and that is a huge part. It's probably where a lot of advisors fall over, is that touching base, you know, that every, whether it's fixed rate rollover or whatever, or at least every year, just saying, hey, how's it going? The amount of time I do that, especially first time buyers, oh, we've got a baby. It's like, bingo. I feel like finding up saying, have you got a baby yet? but it's lovely. It's a great thing to celebrate. So it's a funny old world. The hardest people in the world at the moment are people my age and older. As I'm seeing and hearing a lot from them, because they're used to how the banks used to be, and make assumptions based on that. And it's just not the same anymore. It, you know, If you're in your early 60s and you're still carrying debt, the road narrows. Put it that way.
Yeah. Yes, you don't get as employed as easy. You can't really get debt because you're potentially not going to be able to pay it, even though it used to make sense on paper. You know, you've got these assets that cover it, but they want you to have an income that can support it over the long term.
What do you think? What's
been the biggest shift, do you think, in lending or changes that you're seeing since you first started?
Well, is it a shift? I think the biggest shift, I think COVID had a huge, you know, the C word, had a huge impact. Whereas the minor banks that used to be these tiny little dots on the landscape, they had that they were able to pivot. They had the mobility to actually come up and come right up the backside of the main banks. And they are significant players now, the minor banks, so your Co-ops, your TSBs, your SBSs, and those. You know, they, having that flexibility, already having great online systems because they weren't branch focused, they were, you know, they were able to really rise to the game. Our second tier or near banks, the same story with those, with the changes in the CCCFA and responsible lending. A lot of very viable lends didn't happen, because of it. Couldn't happen. And so, you know, those near bank players that had been deemed second tier before, you know, not point of last resort, but, you know, job specific, they have actually come more into the regular lend space now, you know, whereas historically, if you've gone to Bluestone, it was, you know, there was a reason for it and we'll try and pull you back into mainstream as soon as we can. But, you know, with the products and the rates that they're now advising and the access, I mean, they're doing cashbacks, you know, they're up there, for people that are, you know, haven't been self-employed for long enough, or have had a change in vocation or change in circumstance, or I had a credit issue with it, you know, doesn't have to be a huge one. Now it's a derailer with some banks over a certain level. So I think that's the biggest change over the last 3 or 4 years. Is a lot more viable options. Obviously, you want, you know, you don't want there to be fees. You want it to be great rates. You want it to be very, very, very solid lender. I'm extremely mindful about where I'll put lends. It has to be, you know, if for the second tier, if they don't do private lending, if they're in that space, they're only, you know, only companies, etc., outside the CCCFA, then, you know, I caution. I say there's a reason why they work in that space, and make sure the client is thoroughly available. And that is when you drill down and make sure, like you mentioned before, when people come and say, I've told, I can just say what my earnings are and off we go. And it's like, well, now you'll pay an upfront fee of, you'll get this sort of an interest rate, and you will not have the protections that CCCFA gives you. On recourse, you're assuming that you're saying, I know everything there is need to know, I'm going in eyes wide open. And quite often they're not. So I don't go there very often with clients. I bring them up to a level where they're with reputable impaired credit lenders, as opposed to the not quite so. We have access to literally over 100 lenders now. There's phenomenal depth of the market. I mean, it's historically, when I was on my own, I was only doing residential lending. Now I'm tapping into business lending, into commercial lending, into asset lending. And the more you talk, we meet twice weekly, is different. So it's the group residential, advisors, and as the commercial and hybrid advisors. Every week you're getting different lenders in front of you, giving you a synopsis of where their space is, what they can do, why it's worth keeping their number on your file. And, so yeah, it's evolved a lot in the last 5 years.
Yeah, I'd be curious if there's something else you talked about, like, you know, you don't think about money, you don't think about trail, and that's probably why you're not, you know, a billionaire. But I'd be wondering, it's not too uncommon.
Can you edit this for the bit if my husband watches it?
Remove that.
He'll sell me down the Swanee.
Yeah, well, it's a common thing. I would come across a lot of business people or sales people that are very relationship heavy. They care deeply. They do a great job and they get referrals, and they have that barrier in terms of acquisition or pushing it or putting their self-interest forward. What's your advice to a person starting in the industry like you and has that sort of relationship heavy approach and has that a limiting belief around money?
I think you've got to be true to yourself. I don't think it's limiting. I would not sell my soul to have the bank balance. You've got to be true to yourself. I mean, if I changed myself, if I was different, then that would be more comfortable with it. But no, it's not the driving force. As long as I can, it's not totally altruistic. I'm getting in there. I get the kick from getting the results. I get the kick from actually having that ongoing long-term relationship. I mean, it's the difference between hunting and farming. So if somebody new coming into it, it would depend on their nature. I mean, if they are a, you know, all bloody sparkly out there podcasting every 5 minutes, you know, razzmatazz type person, then it's like, you go for it. Probably last thing they want is somebody sitting in the office crying, saying, my husband died, I've got this mortgage, I've got this insurance payer, I don't know what to do next, what should I do? That's what, you know, that to me is, that's part of my job still. You know, that is a huge part of my job. To those people, it might be, talk to your lawyer. It's really hard for people to actually, you know, pay $300 for a lawyer, or probably not dissimilar for an accountant to sit down with them, whereas people like us, because the banks pay us, we can say, hey, this is the specialist you need to talk to. You know, this is a possibility, run it by this person. I can't actually advise in those spaces, but I can say, I think this is worthwhile looking at, run this past and run this past a family, et cetera, et cetera. Somebody new starting, I'm a people person, so I'm all about, you know, not schmoozy networks. I thought networks were really awful concepts for a long time. That whole, you know, I'll scratch your back if you scratch mine, I'll say you're great, I'll like your post, and it's like, I hate it, you know, nah, you know, no, it's not for me. I'll fly by the strength of my own achievements. And I made a pact with myself to venture along to a BNI group, and I sat back and I thought, oh, this is all a bit odd, a little bit like Masons and secret handshakes. But I thought, no, I'll give it whatever, 3 or 4 visits, which you're allowed to do. And, yeah, once I got that little bit more insight into the people and the caliber of the people, it became the penny dropped, that it's it only actually ticks. You only tick if you're as good as you say you are, and you make those people look good by having referred you. And so it is kind of cream rises to the top, in my opinion. And so I have stayed part of that network for 5 or 6 years probably now. It's great being I work on my own apart from my trusty hound. And yeah, it's for me to actually sit around a table of other businesses, other professions, is great. I have an accountability relationship with one of the other solo operators there, and we don't, you know, we plan, we don't hold back. And like I say, there's honesty. We know that you do a good job. One of the referrals over the weekend actually was by a visitor that came to that particular group, and it's a family member of theirs. And that's a really heartwarming and touching compliment. Please look after this person for me. And so I will. They'll be spoken to today, and we'll see what we can do. But so yeah, make networks, be true to you. But I don't think people should try and be. I don't think people that aren't shiny salespeople should try and be them. If you're a farmer, you're a farmer. These nice, safe, at home in your own office, like podcast things, are about as big and bold as people like me would get. Other than this, you know, I chat to anybody and everybody, be it a bus stop, you know, walking the dog. I have no problem talking to people, but I'm not a big pusher. I have no problem making cold calls. I mean, I returned your call thinking you're my son that had lost his phone. We had a yarn.
It's a very helpful name, right? Very common. Yeah, I mean, I think there's something, like, that's the easiest way for them to win. You know, you partner with someone that has access to your dream clients, and you just focus on being a good person, doing things right by them. I think there's something fundamentally wrong with the way people acquire referrals. It seems like such a high bar. Like, to get a referral from me, you would need to know me maybe a year. I'd need to see how you run things and how you do things and get an understanding of it, and then also see what people have said about you, and also to assess your behavior if it's aligned with what you say over a consistent period of time. That's such a massive bar, and I've probably got more trust issues than the average person. But there must be a more thoughtful way to get referrals, and I think a good example in this podcast, I mainly said this guy's name 100 times, and his name's Alex Hormozi in America, never met him. And the only reason I refer him is because he created remarkable content that is so valuable and helpful. that I refer people to the content, not him. And I never feel as though I'm losing status because I know what to expect from the content because it's there.
Mm.
Do you ever think of how to get referrals and how to make it easier for them to not have such a barrier to resistance?
Oh, it's a yes and no. So yes, a referral, the bar is high. I mean, I think there's whatever, half a dozen different types of people. Some people just want to be really popular. And for me, my big thing, like you, is trust and authenticity. It's nice if people like me, but it's not essential to like me. It makes life easier. I still do a damn good job for you, but I might have to actually button off the friendliness, really. But for me, a different way of getting referrals, all I can do is prove myself over and over again. And social media has been a game changer for people like me. Instances where people put on a local thing, do you know a mortgage over? I mean, I haven't strung armed my clients. I don't ply them with bouquets every time they do it or whatever. But the fact that they are falling over themselves to say, give her a call. I can't pay. It's gold. I can't pay for that. I couldn't pay for better than that.
Mm. So, I wonder if there's something really valuable. Here you go.
Sorry. No, it's a case of there's a variety of clients, and obviously depending on what people are after, as to whether it clicks or not, or the communities are in. Yes, that's probably quite regionally centric where I am, even though I've got clients all over the place. Maybe I should be capturing more of those testimonials and brandishing here, there and everywhere. And if the way I work rocks someone's boat, they might give me a call. But there's a lot of advisors out there. That's probably what makes it hard, actually, finding the one for you.
Yeah, it's an interesting point.
Because swipe left.
It's always
advisor Tinder.
Tinder.
Mm.
So that's how I got introduced at the conference. It was like, Ryan has fine advice. It's like Tinder for advisors.
Yeah. I think it is like that. And I do think it's really important that you actually click with the person, because hopefully it will be something you're catching up with that person once or twice a year for the next 20 years. Now that's ideally, they'll introduce you to other specialists and what have you, but as long as you're doing a good job, that's how it should be.
It's interesting. I wonder if I actually could make something like that. But would like you have someone, they want to solve a problem. They want to buy a house, they want to protect their family, or they want to fund their retirement. And you could have a ChatGPT bot built into your website. They talk into it or they type into it. And then it pulls up a selection of advisors, and you have like a visual representation of their characteristics. I wonder if you could even filter it by honesty, integrity, or political leanings or whatever.
I don't know what would be in my one. It is hard. But a lot of, again, it's that same old thing. What people want to think they need isn't actually what they do need quite often. You know, there's... It's quite funny. Somebody said, I'm after a social media. They're like, I want a kick-ass mortgage advisor. And I did actually think it was quite tongue-in-cheek, but from quite a long time ago, actually, a young guy actually went on there, go see Nicholas, she'll certainly kick your ass if it needs kicking. I was thinking, that's probably not what they were looking for. I don't know that's actually in my favour, but they did give me a call. So he must have been a mate, and he must have actually given him a debrief. But it did make me chuckle. But yeah, some people just want someone that's going to sit there and say, yes, take notes and make it happen, irrelevant of whether it's the right thing or a good thing for them. The amount of people that say, I want an offset. Offset's a fantastic tool. It's a brilliant tool, bloody awesome tool. You know, it's like, well, okay, what are you accumulating money for? Personal tax? Have you got an inheritance? You're over there, you've got ring fence. What are we anticipating using this offset and how? And they haven't. They've got like $3.50 in a savings account. And it's like, well, you're going to be paying floating rate on there. And it's like, well, no, I've been told it's the only way to go. And it's like, let's wind it back. Let's work towards needing an offset, eh? If that's what you want to do. But yeah, it's people come in with a lot of preconceived ideas and they think they know what they want, but they don't always know what they need.
Well, that's the art, I think, is giving them what they want so you can give them what they need.
Yeah.
Because that's how you attract people. It's like, for example, eating healthy and going to the gym and surrounding yourself with good people is good. But, you know, that's a higher bar for people to do. And maybe they want to get liposuction first, or maybe they want to have this slim tea. And that's what I always struggle with financial advice is, like, what's the carrot that gets dangled? What's the thing that attracts people to you? Obviously, with mortgages, it's not too hard because you're like, I want a house. That's my motivation. But how do we make financial advice sexy? How do we make people actually want it? Because I think a financial advisor is just a life coach that uses money as the excuse.
True. I think it would be, much as I respect the changes with the regulation, with the making sure people are qualified in the stuff they're talking about, I talk about a lot of stuff that I'm not signed off to do, but say, check this with a such and such, you know, in the other areas, and that there's not many of us that are signed off, you know, like it used to be that you could do the investment strategy, you can, you know, the insurance. I mean, I used to be signed off on insurance. I never did it because it used to make me cry. Like, no, I'm no good at that. I can't. But I'm the biggest advocate for it, you know, but not legacy insurance, but, you know. And so when I speak to people, I think they realize actually on that whole protect front, I'm not writing the business. I'm going to refer them. But it's like, for Christ's sake, talk to somebody. You don't want to be out of the plane and trying to make a parachute on your way down. Get yourself a small parachute. You know, if your budget's tight, get something that's going to slow down your descent and possibly save you going splat. It's just protect what we've achieved is how I phrase it here. We've done good. You're in a great position. Let's just put either a little safety net, just a little something, in case the, you know, unanticipated at some stage happens. So I don't have any issue. I've got a fantastic insurance guy that I refer to. I have total faith in him. He's the only insurance guy I've ever known that will actually, when he reviews people's stuff, will actually get them to reduce things. And that had me sold on him. And he's a lovely guy. And he's Welsh, and he's got the best repertoire of jokes I've ever heard, which he saves for conferences, not with clients. But, yeah, it's a finding somebody. But to be honest, if people like me, they'll like him. So it's a good transition. Some, you know, a young wham-bam, kiss me quick type client probably wouldn't would do their insurance online and miss out on an awful lot of insight, information, better pricing, blah blah blah.
I didn't realize how important insurance was until I had to sell it on their behalf, and it was just like I don't give advice, I just book them in the appointments, but I talk to maybe 3 dying people a week. And that's just with 2 clients. So imagine if I have 10 clients. So I'd be talking to 15 people with cancer, heart failure. Like I was talking to someone, 47. Oh, their wife's 47. They're in their 50s. They've got heart failure. Like wife's dying of cancer and they've got a young kid. No, so she must be younger than 47. Yeah, 9-year-old. So... And their mum had to fly from China to come look after the children, but she has to get a special visa to in order to, for her to look after the child. But basically, they're fucked. Like, and they want insurance. And then on the other side of things, you talk to people that haven't got any health issues, and they're like, oh, you're just trying to flog us something. You're just trying to make money. I'm like, well, yeah, but I mean, if you talk to those people I talk to every week that are dying, like you'd be like, oh, well, maybe I'll get a little bit of cover.
That's all I say to people. You know, it's up to each to their own. And I tell you, it's a really good to have quite a robust conversation with a couple, especially a young couple, first home type thing, because it's amazing when you actually get them to start having that conversation, because it's all been bloody beautiful and starry and, you know, love soaked. But in actual fact, what do you expect to happen if you know, the only person, as I see it, by and large, any person you want looking after you if chips are down is your other half and vice versa. And they often don't talk about that. They don't talk about what they would want to happen with things once they've passed and da, da, da. It's like, actually, have those gnarly conversations now, because it's much nicer to do while you're blissfully in love than while things have got a little bit real in 20 years time. You know, going through those and ironing out expectations and understandings, and finding middle ground, has got a lot to be said for. And it's, you can't, I just always suggest getting some basic cover when you're young and healthy is a good investment, because once you've got a quirky thing or an oddity going on, then there's all sorts of questions around it and potential exclusions and what have you. And swerving the underwriters and getting it online is not actually a solution. Then you're truly paying for something. Oh, here's a trampoline, but this happens to be a net. It just happens to be a whole underwear exactly you need it, because they're not going to cover it because it's pre-existing, blah, blah, blah. You need, I don't know why, people have this huge thing about paying for the service industry. So, you know, accountants and lawyers get away with it to a degree, but the people like us and insurance advisors and what have you, the fact that we get paid, they see it as though you're doing some sneaky thing, some sneaky backhandy thing. It's like, yeah, we get paid. We work fucking hard and we get paid for it. But the reality is that a lend that I put into place in 2015, actually did it in the bank before I left. So got out of captivity then, thank God. But they moved with me. Not, I didn't initiate it, but they actually moved. And so it was a lend from way, way back then. I got paid in 2015. So probably something giddying like $3,000 or $4,000 then. But I still speak to them twice yearly. We restructure them. They've now got an investment portfolio and done other things. But the point is that, you know, you get paid for that deal once, but you look after them for potentially 30 years. In actual fact, it's a bargain. And the clients aren't even paying it. It's extraordinary, the mentality around it. I think we've been undervalued and undersold as a profession, to be honest. Underrespected. Oh, for sure.
Yeah. We'll change that narrative one podcast at a time. Well, you've done a whole podcast, so thanks for coming on.
Oh, God, I'm bored you to tears. Now, this is good for insomnia. That is what my vow was to my husband. If nothing else, it would have its purpose in life for that.
Okay. Well, enjoy your sleep, people.